from the compact disc In the Evenings out there on ECM Records. It's Paul Blay with a tune called Married Alive. You're listening to WAIF. I'm Chris Comer and happy to be joined with Paul Blay. Hello, Mr. Blay.
Hi, Chris.
How you doing tonight?
Doing great.
How do you achieve that feel of something that's more than just jazz by improvising? It almost sounds like contemporary classical music.
Well, it's jazz in the sense that it's made in America, and in classical music, you usually have European folk references. In the case of Bartok, it would be the folk music of his country, and I guess you could say that this piano music is the folk music of this country.
Well, I'll tell you something. When I'm listening to some of your improvisations on the piano, you'll get halfway into something that sounds really contemporary or something that has a lot of notes, and then all of a sudden you'll be hearing all the blue notes, and then I'll hear the jazz influence that comes out. You've got a lot of blue style in your playing, don't you?
Well, the first band I ever played with was called Al Cowan and his Tramp Band. And it was a black band in Montreal that put on a tramp outfit and played washboard. And the tenor player's favorite tune was a Ben Webster cover called Danny Boy. And that was how I started. So the blues was my earliest influence.
The blues is one of the most striking things about your playing. And like I just said, as advanced or contemporary or as far out as the improvisation sounds, I always hear you come back to a blues scale or something that's got that feel that either gives it a little bit of funk or a little bit of jazz to it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. That's exactly what I'm hoping to do, Chris.
Well, the jazz music in the 40s in Montreal was a lot different than it is to now, isn't it?
Well, I was fortunate in that in those days, the big bands, when they came through Montreal, the French girl would marry them, and they'd wind up having a family, and they're making Montreal their home. So before I went to Juilliard in New York, I was lucky enough to be able to play with a lot of New Yorkers who were living in Montreal from part-time when you weren't on the road.
How long were you at Juilliard?
I was there from 50 to 54.
So you did more time there than Miles Davis did, didn't you?
Well, Miles Davis succumbed to Charlie Parker's offer to go to California and play at Billy Berg's club.
And then why did you hang in music school?
Well, I was in New York City, so I didn't think the music school would be of any use, but New York City certainly would be.
But did you have to pay tuition?
Oh, absolutely. But of course, being a pianist, I was able to work weekends and make recordings and so forth and manage to pay my own tuition.
Well, for the uninitiated listener, tell us for a little bit about how you've grown along with jazz over the years.
Well, I was, started off with swing music, which included, I worked opposite Louis Armstrong, but I did get to play in a band with Ben Webster and a band with Lester Young, and that was the best of swing music, the Count Basie band Sidemen. And then when I went to New York, I got to play with Charlie Parker and make a record with him. So that was bebop. And by the time we got to 1955-57, there were changes in jazz, and I happened to find myself in California and hired Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman. So that was the first stage of free jazz. And then coming back to New York in 64, I played with Albert Eiler and Gary Peacock and Paul Motion, and that was the second stage of free jazz in which there was no time at all. So in terms of acoustic music, I was lucky enough or intuitive enough to be in the right city at the right time with the right players so that I could learn how to do these various styles of playing, and I find that it is a linear evolvement. One leads to the other.
In a space of about 40 seconds, you went from Ben Webster to Albert Eiler. And has jazz music progressed as fast as it did from the mid-40s to the late 50s? If I think about jazz, in 1984 even, things haven't really moved along as fast as they did then, have they?
No, artists and musicians are very lucky to be in their 20s, coinciding with a decade that happens to be a fertile time of change. The operative word here is change. If the music is changing, then you can reserve a corner of it for yourself, perhaps a style involving very few notes, perhaps a virtuoso style, but being early, you can pick a corner and you can claim it for yourself as your own. But that was the 60s, but if you were 22 in 1970 or 1980 or even 1990, you were out of luck because you weren't going to be with the originators, you were going to be with at least the first first generation, maybe second generation players.
Well, isn't it about time for something to turn jazz on its ear again?
Well, I'd be happy to talk to you. You know, I've always considered myself a crystal ball gazer for the purpose of trying to be 5 years ahead of the curve so that when the curve came there, I'll already have known how to play. But the thing about the future is that when you find out, if you get any advance notice of what's coming, you can always tell that it's the future because you won't like it.
Well, what do you think of rap music then? You know, a lot of people have told me that rap music was the music of the future. It was the newspaper of the streets. And nowadays, even that seems a little old-fashioned.
Well, I mean,
rap music is excuse the change of volume here. Rap music is very healthy because it involves poetry. And we haven't had a wide public for poetry before.
Do you do a lot of music with spoken word and poetry? I know that Cecil Taylor, who's a contemporary of yours, does a lot of poetry now.
Well, I've always been interested in poetry, and having spent some time in California and San Francisco, I got to know a lot of poets. We did do some concerts at NYU with William Burroughs in the early 60s, and also with Allen Ginsberg in New York in the early 60s.
What do you think about trends in jazz these days? There's a certain trend that some artists are becoming popular above the board, people like Modesky Martin and Wood and things, where they're attracting a mass audience now of people like Grateful Deadheads, and there's also young upstarts like Susie Ibarra and Matthew Shipp from New York City.
Uh-huh. Well, there are some players whose destiny it is to have a wide audience, and sometimes the player comes first and the audience comes second. You know, but when they're both at the same, when the audience and the music coincides, you have a happy period.
So, what is the future of jazz? That you were saying you were the crystal ball. So, lay it on the line here. What's going to happen in 2005 in the world of jazz?
Well, you know, the thing is that because first of all, the 90s are an exciting time, and it's not because they've gone beyond 12-tone music or because they've gone beyond free tempo or any of those innovations, or they've gone beyond synthesizers or electric keyboards. That's all been happening. What we're dealing with now is a shift from the music that's on a record that only has sound to a record that has sound and images. So the artist is now responsible for a twin palette, one of music lasting 70 minutes and one of visuals lasting 70 minutes. Now, if you're a purist and you prefer to have your music without visuals, you can turn the monitor off. But the record buyer is going to expect for their $20 an hour plus worth of music plus an hour plus worth of images, which is going to be wonderful for graphic artists, for painters. My wife is a painter and a video artist, Carol Goss. And it's going to be interesting for musicians because both of these things can be done in real time if the artists feel that that's the way they want to go.
Thanks a lot for taking a few minutes to talk to us tonight, Paul Blais. I want to get into a little bit of music, and then maybe we'll talk some more.
Great.
In 1973, you released a record that sort of turned solo jazz piano on its ear, at least according to the history books, called Open to Love. It was on the ECM record label. And at the time, I recall from reading, you had just finished a period of working a lot with electronic music, and then you returned back to solo piano. What happened next?
Well, there was some musical feed into the acoustic music, because the sustained electronic music, you could hold a note for much longer than you could in the piano. So it was my desire to try and strike the instrument so that notes would last longer than they normally do before they decay.
And then this record, Open to Love, came out, and you had not made a solo piano record previous to that.
No, I hadn't. No.
How come?
Well, nobody had, really. Once we got past free jazz, there wasn't really, it was Manfred Eicher at ECM decided to record three pianists, Chick Corea, myself, and it was Keith Jarrett. And he offered us a possibility of playing solo. Well, I told him I'd call him back because I had never thought of it. And a week later at a rehearsal, when I was rehearsing my quintet, I was showing the tune to the band, and rather than stop after showing the tune, I said, well, this might be a good opportunity for me to try and play solo, and I kept playing the tune into the solos, and I found that, in fact, it was easier to play solo than it was to play with other musicians. And so I called Manfred back and said, yeah, let's go ahead.
Talk to us for a minute about the technical aspects of the record, because I also recall reading that you mic'd the piano differently than it had ever been mic'd before.
Well, I'm not sure it's my innovation, but I think Manfred at ECM agreed that there was a way to record solo piano that produced a resonance and a reverberation that was that allowed the notes to be held longer, and that was part of my philosophy as well. So it was a happy agreement.
And you put the microphones up under the hood of the piano, up real close to the strings, and you used more than one microphone, didn't you?
Yeah, that way you have the choice in the mix to use a close mic. See, every pianist strikes the instrument differently. So by putting a variety of microphones at different heights on top of the strings, you can pick the height of the recording, which, for instance, if you hit the piano really hard, you might want the mics to be a good distance away from the strings. And if you were a softer pianist, you might want it to be close. So if you do multi-track, you can choose later which mics you want to turn on and which ones you want to turn off.
And do you ever regret releasing this record when you did? Because Open to Love came out, the world apparently ate it up, and then after that, everybody and their brother put out a solo piano record, everybody from George Winston to Peter Cater to people you've never even heard of, because their music was bland and milk white.
Well, of course, you know, it's wonderful to be able to influence the period and be able to say, hey, this is a fertile ground, why don't we all go there?
You know, some people might say that you might have invented New Age music with this one, but I don't know about that.
The proper name for New Age is Old Age.
Paul Blais, we're talking to Paul Blais on WAIF. We'll be right back. We're going to play a track called Ida Lupino, WAIF. Rarely do you hear drums recorded that nice. That's Paul Mochin and on the drums with Gary Peacock on bass doing a Paul Blais tune called Figfoot. Before that, we heard Figfoot from the album Closer that came out in, what year was it, Paul, like 1964?
Something like that, yeah. I think a little earlier.
And the two tunes sounded completely different to me. To recap briefly, the record from 64 sounds like this.
Oh, okay.
Right. And then the new version goes kind of like this. And while they're both based in the blues, obviously, they sound different. So I wanted to ask you, what's the deal with the two different takes of the tune?
Well, not necessarily. The you know, what we're really doing is playing these very short themes, which are supposed to be memorable. They don't necessarily follow the same sequence from the one take to the other. So you might hear that theme somewhere in the middle of the second take of that tune. The point being that we want you to leave the concert hall humming.
Well, you've got a lot of tunes like that that appear on, I'd have to say, many of your records will have these recurring tunes like Around Again, Turns, Ida Lupino, Seven, and oh, there's dozens of them, I think, that appear on, I'd say, I have to say, a majority of your records.
Well, there are tunes written by my wives. In the case of Carla Bley, Ida Lupino that you played earlier is her tunes, and in the case of things like So Hard It Hurts, Ned Peacock.
Nothing Ever Was Anyway is a nice one too.
Right. Yeah.
Because that's turned up on at least three records of yours that I have, and I'm sure many more than that.
Yeah, many more on a lot of other people's too, because that was recently recorded in trio. By Marilyn Crispo on ECM. She recorded a two-record set of Annette Peacock's compositions.
She's good, too. I've got a couple of her records.
Mm. Yeah, she's very good.
Who are some other contemporary pianists that you think are just completely down with it?
Well, I'm very concerned about influences when it comes to one pianist to another. So as far as I'm concerned, it's not a good idea for a pianist to listen to other pianists.
That makes sense, because all of a sudden, dude, sounds like Art Tatum, right?
Well, when I go to a pianist's house, I throw all his piano records out the window.
Huh. We're talking to Paul Bley on the Chris and Rob Show. My name's Chris Comer. I'm here until 12 o'clock tonight when the Outside Inside Jazz program comes in here. And Paul, if you're ever in Cincinnati, you got to catch this guy's show. Lee Harvey comes in here every Tuesday night at midnight. And he plays everything he can throw at you, everything from Sun Ra and Archie Shepp. He's got a bunch of your records. He's got it all, man.
Hmm.
So you might like to check this guy out.
Okay.
You've played with, I'd have to say, almost every notable personality I can think of in the last 50 years in the world of jazz music. You've played with Charlie Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Could we talk for a few minutes about some of the individuals you've played with over the years, and not necessarily gossip or anything, but talk a little bit about their styles and their influence and what they were all about?
Well, the interesting thing about jazz, one of the perks about being in jazz, is that not only do you have individual music played by different famous musicians, but you have different individual lifestyles. For instance, you have costume. Dizzy had his costume. Lester Young had his pork pie hat.
Sun Ra.
Sun Ra had his Eastern fez. And,
it was a Saturn fez.
Saturn fez, correct.
He got that fez from Saturn, baby.
And the reason he did that was because he could hide headphones in the fez. And when he spoke with you, he would hear your squeaking voice delayed by several seconds.
Really? I didn't know that.
See, now you know something.
Yeah, that guy's a character. You did play with Charlie Parker, and I read a little bit about that in your new book, Stopping Time. It's out on Vehicular Press. I know I'm not saying that right. So check it out. Stopping Time, Paul Bley and the Transformation of Jazz, written by yourself and a ghostwriter, David Lee. And you got a chance to comment on just about everybody you've ever played with in that book.
Mm-hmm.
You played with Sonny Rollins when he had a Mohawk haircut.
During that period, yeah, when we went to Japan, he was he didn't carry suitcases. He carried barbells to Japan.
Well, what for?
I guess it was a way to increase his physicality.
Well, in the early 60s, the punk rock scene hadn't really hit the big time yet. What was Sonny Rollins doing with a mohawk?
Well, this was for a Museum of Modern Art in New York concert. I shaved my head, and he left a strip on the top.
Pretty cool. And what about, there was a big article on you and your music and some concerts you had coming up in the New York Times a few weeks back. But after I read the article, I thought, the New York Times spent more time talking about when you were in attendance at a big Ornette Coleman concert in 59 than it really talked about you. What kind of an influence did Ornette Coleman have not only on the jazz scene in the late 50s, but on you and the way you played with your trio?
Well, when Ornette, when we finished in Los Angeles with Ornette and Don Cherry and Charlie Hayden and Billy Higgins, and the band came east without the piano at the Five Spot, then the piano was in jeopardy. There was a good possibility that there wouldn't be any more piano in modern jazz, and that we would have pianoless groups, and you know all the pianoless groups, Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, etc., etc. So the trick was to find a role for the piano, and in the small group music, there was never piano parts. Nobody gave you harmony parts or what to do and so forth, so you sort of had to improvise and invent your way to a piano part. And because the piano was at risk, I spent a lot of time thinking a lot about what the role of the piano was and how to achieve micro tonality on an instrument that was designed for a well-tempered pitch.
You could have always retuned it.
No, the problem there is that you're stuck with the new tuning. The trick was to get the microtonality when you wanted it and to not have it when you didn't want it.
Well, a lot of guys would take paper clips or pieces of paper or anything and attach it to the strings on the inside to make it buzz or click or sound differently.
Right, but
prepare it.
But prepared piano is exactly what you said. But what we were looking for was the ability to take the note and have it be non-specific in terms of pitch, but near the original note, so that you would, in a sense, be bending the notes. And you'd play something that would be suitable for a saxophone player, which wasn't using any pitch at all. In the case of Evan Parker, for instance, and circular breathing, he plays high, low, thin, and wide, but you wouldn't be able to notate the notes. But like Billie Holiday said, the impossible will take a little while.
Mm-hmm. And then that's when you put together some of your trios that have really turned the jazz trio situation on its ear.
Well, playing with the trio allowed the new advances in improvising that came in the late 50s and early 60s were, in a sense, making the job easier. Because if you didn't have to worry about steady bars and chord changes, then you could shape your playing the way you felt it and the way you heard it, as opposed to fitting into a standard rhythm and a standard set of chord changes. You had the option of playing in time or out of time, with changes or without changes.
Now, the way that you solved the problem and the way that another one of your contemporaries, Cecil Taylor, solved the problem seemed to me to be a dichotomy of two different approaches, where Cecil Taylor can be quite violent playing with his fists and his feet and playing big fat clusters. The sound is very thick. Sometimes your sound is downright gentle compared to his.
Well, I think one of Cecil Taylor's main innovations in jazz was that he led the way for drummers to stop playing tempo. And he, in a sense, played drum parts with the drummers and used the percussive part of the piano as a way of breaking up their rhythm.
Have you ever talked to Cecil Taylor or had a summit? Have you guys ever hung out and talked about music?
Well, we've played a lot of concerts together. What usually happens is he plays ballads and I play free.
Okay. I got to admit, I haven't heard a whole lot of records except for some of the real old ones where Cecil Taylor's playing, you know, an inside traditional style.
Mm-hmm.
But you still occasionally will put out a record that's got a tune or a standard on it or something. But you don't play a lot of standards. How come that is?
Well, I do, but I don't title them.
Oh, okay. We're talking to Paul Blais on WAIF, and right now we're talking about some of the different characters and jazz figures that Mr. Blais has played with over the years. Now tell us about Charlie Parker. I read a little bit about this in your book, and it seemed fascinating that you got to hang out with this guy who's considered almost a deity in the world of jazz now.
Well, he is one of the deities in terms of his recordings, the Louis Armstrong Hot Fives, the Lester Young Kansas City Seven, the Charlie Parker Quintet with Miles Davis, the Ornette Coleman Quintet with Don Cherry. These are the Bill Evans Trio. These are the classic instrumental ensembles in jazz that will survive as long as there's recorded music. Personally, he felt like a father figure to me. He was very mature for his age, and there was all kinds of jokes about Charlie Parker, and that is if he made a phone call, you had to stay near him, because if you turned your head, when you looked back again, he wouldn't be there. And that was not because of any irresponsibility on his part. He was just very childlike, and that if he saw some lights in the distance that attracted him, he would just wander. So bringing him to concerts and the video in Montreal, and then playing with him in New York, you just had to, for instance, he'd come 3 or 4 hours late for a job. And the trick was that when he started to play, he had to play three times as good as he normally does to convince the audience that he wasn't late, that it was well worth the wait.
And he generally did play pretty damn good, didn't he?
He was a genius.
Yeah. And what about in the 60s? You were part of the Jazz Composers Orchestra, and a lot of heavyweights were in that band, people like Archie Shepp and Sun Ra.
True, yeah. The interesting thing about the Jazz Composers Guild, as it was JCOA, is that they were all band leaders. So when they played big band music, they returned to the tradition of Duke Ellington, which was to choose musicians who didn't sound like each other. Now, if you have five saxophones who sound exactly alike, you can have five saxophones sound like one saxophone. But in the case of Ellington and Carl and the Jazz Composers Guild Orchestra, if you have five saxophones that sound unalike, then they'll sound like 15 saxophones and get a richer sound. So that was a very exciting band because everybody had a unique sound, Roswell Rudd and so forth.
And would you think that that's about when your style became quite adventurous?
Well, I like to think that my first record that I like was not before the 60s. I had started playing in the early 50s, 53 with Art Blakey and Charlie Mingus on Depa Records. The first record that I really like was Figfoot, which was recorded in 1961, and that was because I took a complete chance and didn't play any songs that I knew and just played some originals that involved were without chord changes. They had steady time, but no chord changes, and for me that was the first, and I've liked that record, and I like every record I made since then.
Every single one?
Correct.
Every 153 or however many there are by now? That's a lot of records to be batting 1,000 on.
Well,
Ken Griffey doesn't hit that many home runs, you know what I'm saying?
Let me put it to you this way. Improvising is making decisions in split second. So at some point, you're not good at that, and you make some decisions you're happy and some that you're not happy with. But after you do it for 10 years, you learn how to make decisions that you want to make or don't play at all. You know, when you put a poster up saying Paul Blay is going to be playing tomorrow night, it doesn't say I'm going to be playing all the time.
It just says you're going to play tomorrow night.
Right. And I have to show up, but it doesn't even say I have to play.
Now, you played with Charlie Mingus back in the 1950s, I think a little in the 60s as well.
He gave me my first record date, yeah.
Did you ever read his book, Beneath the Underdog?
I couldn't believe it was written by him. It was written by a guy who, during a period that I did not know him, so I have no familiarity with the Mingus of that book.
Either that or you just don't want to comment, because I read that book when I was a teenager. My mom actually let me read it, and it's only because she didn't get past the second chapter. But I read that book, and I said, no way. No, there's no way that dude did all that. Not with all those women. Now, you're telling me you're not going to comment, or you're telling me you don't buy it either?
Well, I didn't know the Mingus as the ladies' man. I mean, although he was a sharp dresser, he would wear a bowler hat and would look like a tuxedo and sit in an outdoor coffee shop in Greenwich Village, and he would be, like a landmark. But I know Charlie Mingus as an individual who invented a way of behavior which always got him what he wanted. And I think in the book I tell a half a dozen stories about how he was able to do something. Very briefly, he did something that I think everybody could use and that I've never found anybody who did. He'd be in a meeting with a record executive and he was trying to influence the guy. And so while he was speaking to him, he looked very friendly and spoke very friendly, but twice as loud as normally. And that just had a volume pedal on his voice.
That's great. We're talking to Paul Blay on WAIF at 6 minutes after 11. I'm Chris Comer, and we're here until 12 when the Outside Inside Jazz program will... I think they're going to be bringing you some more Paul Blay music a little into the evening, so stay tuned for Lee Harvey and all that. Now, at some point in the mid to late 60s, the European School of Music started gearing up, and they had a free jazz scene that they didn't even want to be called free jazz because it was so out there. It was somewhere in between jazz and Western classical music and something else. And you've been involved with some of those fellows over in Europe, haven't you?
Well, I like to think that I'm involved with the players that do like to be called jazz and that I've spent a lot of time in the jazz tradition and just happened to be free later on. I think the free jazz that I like best is by players who can also play the earlier styles of jazz, but have just matured into using more freedoms.
What about cats like, I know you have done a record with Evan Parker, and there's another Evan Parker record coming up. And haven't you also played with Han Benning and Peter Brotzman and people like that?
Not with Peter Brotzman, but with Han Benning and Evan Parker, yeah. These are virtuoso players, and I think there was a point in the 70s which the best drummer in the world was European. and the saxophone players were first rank. I mean, jazz before 1960 in Europe was not really leading the way instrumentally, but by the time we got to 1970, the half a dozen to dozen European players were in amongst the first rank of world improvisers.
Well, you know, to this day, a lot of American audiences still aren't familiar with a lot of the European jazz musicians. And you were part of the scene when it came, and weren't some of your trios influential on the European jazz scene of the 60s and 70s?
Well, yes. I've always toured in Europe and with the trios and built a constituency.
Well, you've got a new record coming out with Evan Parker and Bar Phillips, and you've already recorded one with them, Time Will Tell, on ECM Records from 1995. And if anyone has a chance to hear that, it's really a far-out record, especially with Evan Parker doing some of the circular breathing and all that. But the new record, I believe, is called St. Gerold.
Mm-hmm. That's the town in the Austrian Alps that has a monastery where we did do the recording.
I understand it'll be released on ECM Records in 6 or 8 months. I also understand it was recorded in a monastery. Can you tell us a little bit about the session?
Correct. Well, it changed my ideas of what a monastery is. For instance, the priest who runs the monastery was besieged by women who would their husbands would park them at the monastery for about 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, and they would imbibe from the cellar, which had wines that were very rare and extremely attractive. And so the place sits on top of the Alps, so your view is unimpeded by wires and so forth. It's an ideal circumstance. And he has a Bösendorfer Imperial, which is the world's finest piano, in my opinion, and with the extra notes on the bottom. And it was surprising to find. I thought monasteries are supposed to live on bread and water.
No, actually, the monks like to party, don't they?
They sure. Well, the people. People like to party with them, let's put it that way.
Well, monks are known for making wine and beer and things like that. They're world-class brewmasters.
Exactly.
Talking about another jazz musician from Europe that you've played with is NHOP, and that's not the International House of Pancakes. That's Neil Hennings Orsted Peterson. What's that? What was that guy all about? And you recorded a record in, I think, 71 or 72 with him.
Right. Well, when you're asking these questions, what we're really thinking of is what procedures would I use in this record date with Niels Henning that I wouldn't use normally.
Yeah, well, Niels Henning was a European bass player, and there's a record, it's called The Meeting, and it came out on Inner City Records in 1976, actually. I think it was recorded in 73. And it's an interesting record. I'm going to play a track from it here in a moment. And it's interesting to me because you play not only an acoustic piano, but there's an electric piano on it as well.
Well, yeah, I have done a little bit of work with electric music. With Niels Henning, I think the secret was to, since his history with Oscar Peterson is playing tunes, and he's just a wonderful tune player, that I thought the way to find the side of Niels Henning that hadn't been recorded before was to let him start the tunes and, in a sense, invent an ostinato for which I would write a tune on top of while we were playing. He had these beautiful ostinatos that I'd never heard before, and some of them sound like the South Sea Islands and so forth, and I just wrote songs right there at the recording date to fit with his backgrounds.
Well, you do a few of your signature tunes on the record as well.
Mm-hmm.
Olos de Gato is on here.
Yeah, it's a Carla tune.
Yeah, I want to ask you about one more thing about this record. It's a great record. I like the album cover. It's got a picture of you playing piano, and in the background you can see Niels Henning playing his bass. But you're wearing this monstrous early 70s necklace, and I was wondering if you still had it.
No.
It's really cool.
Thank you.
If you still got it, you should donate it to, you know, the Jazz Hall of Fame or something if you've got one of those.
Well, thank you.
Somebody can eat a cheeseburger and say, oh, that's Paul Blais' necklace. Describe that necklace for our listening audience and whatever happened to it.
Well, I think that went along with the synthesizer period, in which I would wear cowboy hats and necklaces and so forth. I was in my costume mode.
Yeah, you were the king of style back then.
Thank you.
I'll tell you that. Let's play a track from this, and I want to point out that halfway through the track, you can almost hear the piano stool squeak as Paul Blais scoots over and starts playing on the Fender Rhodes electric piano, and it's a really nice texture. When did you start using a Fender Rhodes?
Well, the Fender, you know, I always thought that anything with a keyboard was my domain. So as soon as the Fender came out, I started playing it.
There's no records of you playing Hammond B3 that I'm aware of.
No, that's the one instrument that I have. I have a good friend of mine that plays the Hammond B3. I choose not to be the one to play it. I never wanted to compete with my good friend.
I gotcha. Well, this is an interesting record. When I listen to Fender Rhodes, sometimes you think of George Duke or those guys in the late 60s that were in Miles' band, because the Fender Rhodes can be used very funkily and rock and roll styles, too. It's a really wailing instrument, but you use it in a way that's very gentle and very expressive, and it breathes a lot. So let's take a listen to this tune, and then in a little bit we'll come back and we'll wrap up the program and chat just a little bit more. Is that all right?
That sounds good, Chris.
Thanks. We're talking to Paul Blay on WAIF. This is The Meeting. Paul Blay and Niels Henning Orsted Petersen. Thank you. And the Fender really is an expressive instrument, as much so as an acoustic piano, isn't it?
Well, it's become a classic electric instrument, to the surprise of all of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think when the thing was first invented back in the 60s?
Well, there were so many keyboards coming out, clavinet, clavichord, and all that we didn't know which ones would stick, but it turns out Fender was the one that's considered a classic.
Talk to us a little bit about some upcoming gigs that you might have. Do you still play out a lot?
I do quite a bit, yeah. We're going to be at the Blue Note in New York the second week of September.
Wasn't there recently a festival of your music in New York?
Yeah, at Lincoln Center. They devoted some time for me and Charlie Hayden. We played duo there.
Do you play with Charlie Hayden much these days?
I have played with him quite a bit, yeah.
Because I know that you guys got started out about the same time in the 50s, didn't you?
Well, it was actually in the in that period, at 57, 50, 56, 7, 8, I gave Charlie one of his first jobs while he was a student at school in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. When he came to the first rehearsal, he didn't wear shoes.
Why not? Couldn't afford them?
He's from the Midwest, and I guess it wasn't done.
Huh. You know, that guy's been around on the scene now and is putting out some of the best music, whether it's collaborations with other musicians or his, what does he call, his Liberation Orchestra?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the band he had with Carlin.
Yeah, Charlie Hayden has been one of the best jazz cats to come out of America, I'd have to say, in the last 50 years.
He's got impeccable taste.
Oh, yeah. Now, in the 70s, we were talking a little while ago about some of the musicians you've played with over the years. In the 70s, you're credited with discovering not only Jaco Pastorius, but Pat Metheny as well.
Right. I'd hired another guitar player in that quartet, but when he got to the gig, he said that a friend of his was there and would like to play. And I said, well, sure, you can play the first set. So that was Pat. Pat played the first set, and he wound up playing the whole 2-3 weeks.
And then the original guitar player probably wound up playing with some pop band somewhere, right?
Well, actually, he returned to the studios in Chicago.
Oh. See, that's the thing in jazz. You can't ever let your friends sit in, can you? Not if they're any good.
Well, let me put it this way. When you play in a jazz venue in the United States, that if you're playing for another band leader and you falter or you do something wrong, he just has to nod to another keyboardist in the wings, and that was your last note. You play from note to note in the United States.
Well, I've got several of your records that we've played with different guitar players, not only Bill Connors and Pat Metheny, but you've done records with John Scofield and Bill Frisell, all very accomplished guitarists, whether they're playing jazz or some other idiom. Talk to us a little bit about the role of the guitar in jazz music and what's happening. It's come a long way since Wes Montgomery, hasn't it?
Well, in the Wes Montgomery days, piano and guitar were usually opposites, and they were fighting each other, who would pick the right chord sequence and so forth. So they usually stepped on each other's toes. But once the music became more than just a set of chord changes, then the guitar and the piano were as at home with each other as any two instruments.
What's the difference between some of the guitar players I've mentioned and playing with them? Bill Frisell, of course, has a very ambient tone sometimes, and he's a very gentle player. And I've heard records he's done with Pat Metheny, like the Mark Johnson record that came out last summer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the trick for guitar players, Berklee School of Jazz in Boston turns out 700 guitar players every May.
Man.
So if you're figuring that it's been around for 20 years, multiply that times 700. If you're looking for a gig in Boston, you have several thousand guitar players to compete with. The trick, if you're going to play the guitar, is to be able to be recognizable, to find a way of playing so they can tell it's you. And in the case of the guitar, the guitarists you mentioned each have found a way to play. In the case of Sko, he's got a very much of a groove, and his time is very infectious. In the case of Frisell, it's about backpedaling, and so you can't tell he's playing until he's already in the music.
That's right.
In the case of who else did you mention? I would have to mention John Abercrombie as somebody who's very
That's
home
right.
with guitar synthesizers and played with him a lot. So I've enjoyed playing with guitars, and I've made it a, you know, I think of myself as a gunfighter, you know, who put notches on his belt. At first it was saxophone players, then it was drummers, and then bass players, and then guitarists and so forth. I, which is how I wound up playing with a whole lot of different people.
Well, not to belabor the point, but Bill Frisell is one of those guitar players, or one of those musicians for that matter, who, when you listen to him play, if you listen between the notes, the reward is great, because he plays more music between the notes than he does when he's actually playing the notes himself. And I'd have to say that your piano playing has that same quality, just because of the feel and the time and the texture you put between the notes that you play.
Right. Well, it's like a contest. You know, the first person who plays the next chord is chicken.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, you put out your autobiography this year. It's called Stopping Time. And I must say that you didn't use the F word as much as Miles Davis did when he put his autobiography out. What does Stopping Time refer to?
Well, I think it's very specifically, as I mentioned earlier, that in 1958 we stopped playing chord changes, and in 1964 we stopped playing tempo.
Then you just stopped the time.
Yeah, it was about waves. So something would be, medium wave would be the equivalent of a medium fast tempo, and something very fast would be a very fast wave. But it wasn't meant to be metrical. You couldn't set a metronome and have it go tick-tock, tick-tock with the music.
Well, I actually thought that it referred to what I was talking about a moment ago, the space in between the notes, because I'll listen to one of your solos or your improvisations or whatever, and you'll play a phrase or a melody or a sequence of notes, and then you'll stop.
Well, it wasn't so much a question of stopping as allowing the notes to ring to their fullest climax.
Sometimes that part of the note sounds all the much richer and better than the first part of the note, the attack.
Mm-hmm. The decay is the one that lasts. The attack is usually short. The decay can be infinitely long.
That's really neat. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us tonight, Paul Blay, jazz piano player, been on the scene since the 50s. And how many records do you have credited to your name at this point?
Well, that book you have, Stopping Time, lists about 120 Paul Blay records.
Who else has that many records out?
Well, I think Louis Armstrong had about the same number. It was the last time I looked.
Yeah, after I read your book, Stopping Time, people tell me, hey, jazz musicians, they just have filthy mouths. You didn't use the F word in it once. I read Miles' book, and it was just the F word from beginning to end.
Well, that was Miles.
I guess so. You hung with Miles now and then, didn't you? I read that you had a chance to play in his group, and you actually said, Herbie, you take the gig.
Right. Well, Miles and I have been, talking for a long time, and there was a very good chance that we would have been together. But I thought that Miles' use of playing modality, which is just all white notes, was unsuitable for a black man.
Oh, really? After all the cats you've played with over the last 50 years, are there any challenges left or anybody that you'd like to do a session with that you either just haven't had the opportunity to do yet or haven't been invited to play with?
Well, it's a good question. I would say that rather than individuals at this point, there's different ensembles. So for instance, I had a chance to play with 20 string players in Amsterdam for a week of concerts last year, and that was very much a challenge. We played free without any music, and for the first piece, they played for 45 minutes without me. So the question was not how to get them to start. The question was how do you get them to stop.
Well, that sounds like it would have been a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Sounds like a group like the Ensemble Modern. There's groups, many of them are European, that come out and do stuff like that. Has anyone ever tried to transcribe any of your solos or your solo piano or your improvisations?
Oh, yeah, students do that all the time.
Because I would think that if you took a transcription and put it in front of an orchestra with their parts, they may not know the difference between some of your music and some of that, 12-tone music from the earlier part of the 20th century.
Well, written music is its own subject, and maybe some future date we'll have another conversation. We'll talk about the difference between written music and improvised music.
Yeah, because that's a subject that we could do a seminar on that.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to us. We're going to take the show out. First, I'm going to play the opening track to your new record, Not Two, Not One. And I wanted to ask you, it's called Not Zero in Three Parts, referring to the three members of the group, yourself on piano, Gary Peacock on the bass, Paul Mochin on the drums. But the piano, when it starts out, are you using one of those Bösendorfers with the low end?
Exactly.
Because I hear you play some notes on the low end that most pianos can't get to.
Oh, you're absolutely right. They're under a lid.
It sounds really neat. We'll play that, and then we'll take the program out with an extended selection from the album Virtuosi. Barry Altschul, Paul Blay, and Gary Peacock. You guys are just improvising your butts off, and the tune is called Butterflies. Could you tell us a little bit about that before I play it?
Well, that, if I remember correctly, was a ballad of Annette Peacock's, and it had a romantic touch to it. In that period, I was trying to record two LPs, each with different kinds of ballads. So with two LPs, there'd be four tracks. And this was the gentle ballad. There's also the noisy ballad. There's the abstract ballad. There's the loving ballad. I was working on how many different ways I could play long pieces and record a whole side with one piece. So this is one of the tracks of that.
Okay, these are the two cuts we'll take the program out with. And you told me off the air to ask you about the John Zorn answering machine joke.
Okay, the John Zorn answering machine. A friend of mine needed an alto saxophone player. I said, why don't you call John Zorn? So he called up John Zorn, the answering machine, and says, hi, this is John Zorn. I'm not in at the moment, but when you hear the beep, don't leave a message, because next week I'm going to be in Japan with the Tokyo Philharmonic, and the week after I'm going to be in Berlin with the Berlin Philharmonic, so I don't need this call.
That sounds like a little bit of braggadocio, doesn't it?
To put it mildly.
All right. Thanks a lot, Paul Blay.
Thank you, Chris.